Last week, the COVID modelling from the Doherty Institute, which is what the federal government and the national cabinet are relying upon, continued to be debated, including on this program and many other media outlets. It's important because it helps to define a path to more freedom in the next 2 or 3 months, yet may have been misunderstood in terms of what it promises, and like any modelling, has its limitations. So let's stick to the science rather than the politics and take a deeper dive. Professor Sharon Lewin is director of the Doherty Institute. Welcome back to the Health Report, Sharon.
Pleasure to be here, Norman.
Now, I suppose to start with, any model develops scenarios. It's not predictive of the future. They use a balance of variables. And there are three main variables in yours, just to sort of set the scene, because we'll come back to these. Vaccination rates according to age group, public health and social measures, which is really lockdown masks, and what's called TTIQ, testing, tracing, isolation and quarantine. They're the moving parts, but they're interdependent. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. Perfect.
And the goals, what were the goals you were looking for? Is it suppression? I mean, at various points in the document, it's not clear whether it's suppression or hospital admissions, ICU deaths, or all three. What were the outcomes you were looking for from the model?
Yeah, I'll just start first of all by saying I wasn't directly involved in the modelling, and the modelling's led by Jodie McVernon, who's head of epidemiology here at the Doherty, and was leading a large consortium, about 20 modellers, 11 different institutions around the country. And so what they were really doing with these variables is identifying what the scenarios would be in the future with respect to infections, hospitalisations, deaths, in the context of different thresholds of vaccinating adults, 50, 60, 70, 80%. And what would be those scenarios. And they did it, as you say, for the federal government, and also used a lot of, it's really important to understand how much different sources of information went into the modelling. It's the published literature as well as sort of local evidence from actually Australia itself, whether it's our test, trace, isolate, quarantine capacity, whether it's our vaccine supply, our vaccine implementation. So they used all of those kind of real-world aspects that will impact what those scenarios will look like.
Now, we hear a lot about 70% full vaccination of people aged over 16 being an important threshold. And you can be forgiven from hearing public statements, not by Doherty, but by others, for getting the impression that the opening up is quite significant at 70%, but that's nowhere in your report, not that I can find. You've been quite conservative about what happens when you're at 70%.
Yeah, the modelling, so we've got these variables that you are very nicely summarised, and then we're looking at what are the scenarios with different mixes of those variables at those four levels. And yes, at 70% vaccination of the adult population, if you had what they call partial test, trace, isolate, quarantine, which was defined as the sort of system we had in Victoria in July last year, which we knew was suboptimal, and little to no public health measures, they then had a prediction of the number of symptomatic infections and deaths you would see at those different vaccine thresholds. And then as they layered in better test, trace, isolate, more stringent public and better test, trace, isolate, and then what levels of public health measures, because it's really the public health social measures that are the biggest impact on our daily lives, what impact that would have on cases and on deaths, and at what level could you have fairly minimal public health measures. And so what the model actually shows is that at, 70% and even better at 80%, if you have optimal test, trace, isolate, quarantine, and we can talk about what that might look like and whether that's achievable and at what numbers, you could get away with far less stringent public health measures, a very limited time in lockdowns. Lockdowns were still an option, limited time in lockdowns at 70% and almost not used at all at 80%. But I think the main message that I think was missed by many is that at 70%, it doesn't just go back to normal. You know, at 70%, we can open up safely if we have these additional measures in place, and they will sort of wax and wane over time depending on what's happening with local outbreaks and local epidemiology.
So it's anywhere between 50 and 60% lockdown at 70%. So just before we go on, why did you stop at 180 days? It only goes out to 180 days.
Yeah, there was a pretty strong desire to do that, mainly because 6 months is a really long time in COVID and a lot can change. And once you go out beyond 6 months, even now, you know, what's going to happen with variants, what's we going to see with waning immunity, what are we going to see with boosters? Things could look very different in 6 months. And as you go out longer with all those added variables, your models or scenario planning becomes sort of less tied to reality because a lot can change in 6 months, as we have seen in the last 6 months and the last 18 months.
So let's move to 80%. So at 80%, again, if you listen to the debate, this is nirvana. Yet if you look at the model at partially effective trace, isolating, quarantine, which effectively your contact tracing is the shorthand for that, and the things that go with it, you could be spending 30% of your time in strict lockdown versus, if you like, an optimally effective TTIQ. And that's where this whole debate about the contact tracing comes from, because your TTIQ, the measure you took, and you talked about that, you took New South Wales as optimal in, I think, the first wave and partially effective as Victorian second wave. So 2 points in time, but they were both pre-Delta. So I suppose my question is, can we have optimal test, trace, isolate and quarantine in the world of Delta?
Yeah, I think one important principle is that as you get more and more people vaccinated, you've got fewer and fewer susceptible people, and so therefore the job does get easier. It will get easier when you've got fewer susceptible people. And also, if there is an acceptance of moving from zero COVID to some COVID, and I think that's also an important, it doesn't explicitly say that in the document, but if there is that move, you're not chasing down every single case, contacts of contacts, for example, and getting down to the source of every chain of transmission, which has been our approach to contact tracing to date while we've been at zero COVID. And we're learning with Delta in New South Wales and Victoria that does get harder to do. So the requirements of contact tracing will change, and as will the pool of susceptible people. So contact tracing for the same number of cases in an environment where you've got 70, 80% people vaccinated is a very different beast to what we're doing right now when you've only got 30% of people vaccinated.
Is it with the kind of surge that you're seeing in Israel, in Britain, southern United States, Canada even now?
Is what?
Contact tracing. I mean, at 80%, which is like 65% of the population, you're getting very big surges with very large numbers. I mean, contact tracing starts to become less effective at around about 50 cases from overseas data, 50 cases a day. Seeing that in Victoria at the moment, New Zealand is struggling. Can you really say that contact tracing is going to be so much easier at 80%?
I'm predicting it will. We have had very good contact tracing in place now. No one's saying that we're going to be doing optimal contact tracing with hundreds of thousands of cases. The predictions that you're going to get to hundreds of thousands of cases is with pretty much, you know, virtually no contact tracing and no, or poor contact tracing, yeah, and virtually no public health measures.
And a freedom
I think
day.
We need to see the triple package here. So absolutely taking the brakes on every single public health measure, yes, you'll have problems, and that's what we're seeing in the US. Look at Germany, where you have still got some public health measures and you can keep... Well, the overall goal here is to what they call the transmission potential, effectively the effective reproduction rate, the transmission potential less than one. So the overall goal is that you will bring in public health measures of different severity and hopefully not too much lockdown. And I think the prediction there was at 70% coverage, you'd estimate about 20% of the time in lockdown, 80% virtually no time in lockdown. So you're still aiming to keep that transmission potential less than one.
That's with optimal TTIQ, it's a big assumption. And, of course, New South Wales has got very large numbers and is likely to continue with very large numbers, which means that you've got very much suboptimal, I mean, already in New South Wales with Delta, and even with growing immunisation rates, contact tracing is pretty terrible. It's not the fault of the contact tracers, but, I mean, they still haven't got cases they've gone back to July with.
Yeah, that's right. So what?
How does that affect things?
Well, if you open up with 70% vaccinated with thousands of cases, the model still holds. I mean, the trajectory is the same. You will reach that peak of the estimate of at 70% of 300,000 cases with partial TTIQ. So where you start is important of how effectively your TTIQ can keep, the test, trace, isolate can keep up, which is why the public health measures are still important, which is why there is no freedom day when you hit 70% and you can just do everything.
So, but just to be clear, you're saying there's a set number of cases you're going to reach and it's just a question of how fast you get there.
If you've got partial test, trace, isolate and minimal public health and social measures, clearly work. Now, if you actually look in the document, they're defined as what they call baseline, low, medium and high. And at different times, you will need that. So I think the I'm not really sure where you want to take the questioning other than to try and say that it's going to be very difficult with large numbers. Of course, it's going to be very difficult with large numbers.
Well, wait.
The vaccination does work. Vaccination does break that link between infections and deaths, which we've seen around in many countries. And there will be a shift in thinking of how we will live with COVID. And so what the models try and do is put some parameters around the relative contributions of vaccination, which the more the better. There's no one can deny that. And no one can deny there's a break in the link between infections and deaths. And then what we need to do if we want to maintain these very low numbers of COVID, and I don't think we can talk zero COVID, with what other additional tools do we need? And I think if you look around the world, yes, we are seeing very different scenarios pan out. But the main message is vaccination does still need some public health measures, but we can live differently once we have higher levels of vaccination.
I mean, my point was that you can get explosive growth with a short serial interval. In other words, you get infected sooner. There's probably a higher K number. In other words, a higher proportion of people pass it on. You've got a higher contagiousness, which is probably higher than the estimate you've made at 3.6, which was for New South Wales in March, where there was no outbreak. You could get explosive growth, which means that before you get under control, your hospitals and ICUs are overwhelmed, which is the fear in New South Wales.
Yeah. Let's just go back a bit. The baseline spread of COVID. No one's denying that the ref for Delta is higher between 6 to 8. And the estimate was 3.6 of what we'd already had in place with with test, trace, isolate and quarantine. I think a real unknown at the moment, though, is the real impact that vaccines have on transmission. I mean, that we certainly know the numbers on symptomatic COVID. And the best data on transmission comes from household studies in the UK that was the alpha variant, showing that both AstraZeneca and Pfizer led to a 50% risk of transmission. We don't really know that answer for Delta. So, yes, there are many, many variables here that are still a bit unknown.
Well, we'll keep a close eye on it. My final question, I'll have to be brief because we're running out of time, is have we actually moved beyond, no criticism of the Doherty model, but we've just moved beyond modelling because we're living through it right now and we're seeing the cases from overseas and we've just got to get on and immunise?
Oh, yeah. I mean, modelling all gives you, it helps in the scenario of planning for what to expect. Immunisation, I mean, I think the benefit of immunisation we see so profoundly in so many countries. Look at Singapore, look at Denmark, look at Germany, countries that are vaccinating with public health measures in place. And yes, we've got to move on and immunise.
Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.
Professor Sharon Loon is Director of the Doherty Institute.